From theunce.com, this is the Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Hello and welcome to the Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. Well, today's guest needs no introduction, but I would be in dereliction of duty if I didn't try, so here goes. He's been ranked one of the top 10 DJs on the planet for the past 4 years. He's easily the biggest trance act in North America, so say a handful of IDMAs, and he's on one of the biggest labels in the industry, Armada Music. Marcus Schultz is coming off a huge weekend at Avalon in Hollywood, where he DJed for something like 10 hours over the course of two nights in celebration of his latest release, Los Angeles, the latest installment in his annual Metropolitan Mix series. All the music you'll hear on today's program comes directly from that mix, which is out now on Armada. Schultz has plenty to say for himself, so let's get to it. I guess before we begin, I should say congratulations are in order. You've been nominated for 3 International Dance Music Awards, Best Global DJ, Best North American DJ, and Best Radio Mix for your program, Global DJ Broadcast. After all these years and all these accolades, are the IDMAs still important to you?
Well, you know what? They are important in a way because it kind of validates the hard work. Because, you know, it's not just me. When you get to a certain level, you have to start hiring people to do your PR, hiring people to do office work. I mean, it's like a whole operation. So me personally, I'm flattered by the accolades, but I think it means more to the people that kind of, you know, take care of me and work on my management. You know, they're the ones who really take a lot of pride in what they do. You know, whenever any accolades like this happen, I'm more happy for them than for me. Because at the end of the day, for me, the most rewarding part of my job is, you know, when I'm with the crowds and seeing the smiles on people's faces and just enjoying that, looking out into the audience. And that, to me, is what this is all about. And my team, they don't get to see that side of it. You know, they're just busy working on you know, the interviews and working on photos, and you know, they're constantly working on updating websites and stuff like that. And then for these things to happen, I know it makes them, you know, it makes their job feel like there's something there.
Absolutely. Along those same lines, I mean, once again, you made the top 10 in DJ Mag's top 100 list, and that's definitely a validation of the work that your team is putting in. But I also imagine it's a vindication of North American music, especially, you know, being a North American DJ in a world dominated by Euro house and trance and all that.
Well, you know, I don't really subscribe to the regional thing, you know, North America, Europe, because, you know, I do about 150 shows every year, and they're all over the world, and I get inspired from people all over the world. And I know that, you know, with the internet, especially in our scene, it's not just a North American scene. This is truly an international scene. But that being said, to be in the top 10 again this year, for me, it's more of a validation of this music that we celebrate, because I'm a big fan of this music as well. I love listening to new tracks that come in, like new ideas. And I mean, I'll be honest with you, my radio show, you know, I listen to, I'll put it on my iPod. And when it's like I'm in the right frame of mind, I love listening to it. And that's how I discover a lot of music, too, because, you know, it's one thing to kind of like when I'm working on my radio show, I'm definitely in a different frame of mind than when I'm just relaxed kind of in the car or on an airplane with headphones on and just kind of like being taken away by the music. It's really difficult to be taken away by the music when you're producing the radio shows and you know, to be able to kind of be taken away, be in a different frame of mind, be taken away by the music. You know, I'm a big fan of this as well. So going back to the whole DJ Mag thing, I think it's you know, for all the people, all the artists that are making the music, all the artists that I work with, it's, you know, validation of their work as well. I mean, I'm not the kind of guy who will take, you know, who likes to take credit by myself. I definitely like to give credit to where credit is due. And there's just so many people that are always involved in making this music possible that, to be honest with you, those are the people that I really hope take good pride in, you know, where we are at this point in our careers.
Absolutely. And in that same vein, is this the best time to be in electronic music? I mean, you've been in the business for a while, and you've worked with some huge names in your day, Bette Midler, Madonna, RuPaul. But now you see producers like a David Guetta showing up in videos with Usher and Nicki Minaj. Is this really the time when producers can step out from behind the glass and get the recognition they deserve?
Yeah, but that also comes with a drawback. And the drawback is, I think, the creativity. Sometimes there's too much business involved. And, you know, I think this is a great time commercially to be involved with dance music. But creatively, there's also a lot of people that are really frustrated because the stuff that's being, you know, celebrated on radio and the most popular stuff is really the most kind of watered down version of what we really are into. But that's not just a dance music thing. That happens in any genre, whether it be hip hop, whether it's country and western. I'm sure the country and western people are going, you know, the stuff that's out right now is not the same as it used to be.
Sure.
So I think that's one of the things that kind of gets lost, you know, but I think that there's also a lot of very talented DJs out there that are still giving, you know, showing the message of what the original message was. And I think those are the guys that I really look up to. You know, I definitely respect those guys that are still trying to spread the message of what it really is, what started the whole thing, and kind of the roots of it all.
That's a really interesting perspective. You know, I'm watching the Super Bowl telecast last night, and I see Nicki Minaj and Madonna performing, and there's a dubstep breakdown, and you're working in this. You're basically on the fringe of the pop industry. The producers of your ilk are creating a lot of the music and inspiring a lot of the music that is eventually kicked out as pop music. But I feel like you're sort of torn between that side of the industry and the really underground appeal that dance music has had for you over the course of your career.
Well, not really. I mean, listen, I'm very happy that major labels, major artists are all listening to what we're doing, and they're all trying to incorporate our ideas into their shows. You know, I mean, I think that's a great thing. But I don't come from the school of thought where if you are not eating out of garbage cans and sleeping on people's couches, then you're not like, then you know, you're a sellout.
Then you're not an artist.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, these ideas are great ideas. And if they're great ideas, why not let major pop artists take our ideas and show them, you know, bring them to the mainstream? But for that, I think we should all be rewarded, you know, and that's, you know, at the end of the day, that's, you know, what the major artists are in it for. They're in it for the money, and the money is there, and somebody's going to get that money. That money is going to go into somebody's pockets, whether it's 100% of it goes into Madonna's pockets or Britney Spears' pockets, or if they, you know, send some of the money back to the people that, you know, whose ideas these came from. At the end of the day, why not have people that are creating these ideas get their share of the pie? They deserve it. And, you know, Madonna doesn't deserve to keep 100%, or, you know, Britney Spears doesn't deserve to keep 100% of our ideas. So absolutely, you know, I have no problems with some of our guys, you know, the real creators of this music doing remixes for the major pop artists or even collaborating with them. I have no problems with that because, like I said, that money is there and it's going somewhere and we might as well get our fair share of it. But at the same time, I just hope that, you know, people, these artists stay true. And that is, hey, you know what? There's a scene here that helped cultivate this music, and those artists should not forget about that scene. You know, don't leave your true fans behind. If you're going to do this, then represent your fans as you do this. Don't go and, you know, forget about your fans. And I think that's what some of the artists in our genre have done. They've kind of like, you know, once they've gotten to the point where they can get their piece of that major label pie, they've basically abandoned the fans that got them where they are. And that is what I have a problem with. I have no problems with major, you know, dance artists or even, you know, the respectable dance artist who invented this style working and collaborating with major pop artists. What I have a problem with is when they abandon their fans and they kind of sell out their fans or sell out this music that we love or make it a shell of what it used to be.
Rebels Without a Cause and York, Red Violin, right here on the UNS Podcast.
Obviously, you're passionate about the music, so let's back up. Let's try and figure out how this sound infused itself into who you are. You moved to the States from Germany when you were 13. Had you already been infused with the club music coming out of, say, Berlin or the rest of the country or the rest of the continent? Or had you not experienced electronic music by the time you came to the U.S. as a teenager?
Well, I mean, when I was in Germany, I just started getting into the breakdance scene in Germany, and that's my inspiration for music. I used to listen to, like, Kraftwerk, Soul Sonic Force, you know, those kind of breakdance tunes, which always had electronic keyboards in it and drum machines.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, but at the time, I didn't think of it as electronic dance music. We didn't even put genres on this music. We were just out there breakdancing to it. We were just dancing, you know what I mean? And I think when I came to the U.S., you know, obviously I grew out of the breakdance, you know, music, and that's when I started discovering house music. But I also found kind of I was at a little bit of a odds because, you know, the breakdance music that I liked was more synthesizers and melodies, and the house music at the time was soulful and divas singing and pianos, and you know what I mean? It wasn't like... Mm-hmm. So I always looked for house music that kind of had these synthesizer melodies, and that's kind of how my style grew, is musically, you know, I would search out house music with these synthesized melodies instead of the soulful diva vocals, you know, just look for more synthetic house music.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that, I mean, when as I was growing up as well, as I was kind of getting my feet under me, I started DJing, but I was DJing in top 40 clubs. And so I was always trying to figure out how to fit one or two of these songs that I really liked into my set.
Sure.
And that playing in top 40 clubs kind of gave me the, you know, the experience. First of all, you know, you got to perfect the craft of mixing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also, you know, gave me the experience of reading the crowds, kind of being being part of the party, you know, directing the party and being part of the party. And that just kind of grew to where I was, you know, kind of burnt out with the top 40 scene, started teaching in gay clubs. And that's where I could finally play some of these more synthesized type of house music that I was really into. And then from there, it just grew into where I am now, the, you know, the rave scene, and then into the scene that it is today.
Sure, sure. And I'm always curious because we've got a fan base for this program that is made up in great part by producers who are looking to make that leap to getting their music noticed. First of all, how did you get into moving from simply DJing the tunes of others to production? And from there, how did you find supporters for your tracks and eventually get your music in front of people who could sign you and potentially change your career?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think it's a natural step for a DJ that's really into the art of DJing to move on to producing. You know, I mean, nowadays there's a lot of producers who, you know, have a team of them they come up with a hit record, and then now all of a sudden he has to learn how to DJ so he can go on tour. There's a lot of, you know, artists like that. But when you come up from the art of DJing, you know, as you progress as you master your mixing skills, you start thinking of ways to kind of, what's the next level? You know, after you've mastered mixing two songs together, the next level is starting to kind of make your sets more interesting by either A, re-editing some of the tracks or playing your own kind of mashups of the tracks and when you start doing that, then you start learning, you know, structure, what works, why it works, and then you start analyzing sounds, you know, as you're kind of going to the next level of mixing. And then after that, I just started learning equipment. I mean, the equipment that I was using was just to enhance my DJ sets. So there was kind of a period before I became full-on producer when I was using all, you know, the studio equipment to enhance my DJ sets by adding extra bass lines on top of a track, adding extra percussion on top of a track because I liked the track, but maybe something was missing. Until I got to the point where I'm just like, hey, I'm going to make my own track. And and I'll tell you, I was at a point where I knew what was working. So a lot of people were tapping into me, you know, to help them produce the remix. You know, and I was remixing a lot of major pop artists, but what I was kind of giving the major labels and these artists what they were wanting. And I think when my whole career changed, when that next step was when I said to myself, I'm burnt out, you know, I'm dealing with all these major labels who really don't get it, what it is that we're doing in the clubs. And my whole career changed when I started making music again that was for my DJ sets. And I don't mean just making a track that's a warm-up track for your DJ sets, but making a track that you can play peak hour in your DJ sets and set the dance floor off. And when I started focusing on that, that's when my whole career changed. That's when everything fell into place. And that's the one thing that I tell people. It's like, make tracks that you can play in your DJ sets. Because, you know, there's some guys, very talented guys, that make tracks, but, you know, you can't play them in your DJ sets. Or, I mean, you can play them on your radio sets, and they sound great on the radio, but they don't translate over to the clubs. And when people start making tracks that also work in the clubs, that's when everything will fall into place.
I'm glad you mentioned the labels you had experience with. After all these years with remixes and singles and albums, you've developed this amazing relationship with Armin van Buuren's Armada label. Tell me about that relationship and the lessons that you've learned from one of the top record companies in the world and how that's impacted your own work and how you've chosen to run Cold Harbor Recordings.
I was the first artist ever signed to Armada. Armin and I have known each other since 1999. And when he started Armada with Michael Perrone, who came over from Warner Brothers, you know, Armin introduced me to Michael, and you know, I just we hit it off right away, you know, and Michael is, you know, one of the smartest guys you will ever meet in the music industry. And I think Michael, he does not get full credit for what he's done with Armada. I mean, Michael is like the brains behind it. And, you know, I've learned so much from Michael. I think that is, that I've been putting to use on our label, which is being distributed through Armada. And you know, some of the lessons that I've learned from him is, you know, there's always going to be a faction of our fans that are unhappy with where things are going. But at the end of the day, you know, those fans, they, you know, we love them and they're true fans, but fans age out. You know, they get families, they get, you know, a serious job, and they kind of like drift out of the scene. So you're constantly having to, you know, bring new fans in. Otherwise, you're a dying artist. Your fans are aging out, and you're not replacing them with new fans. So, you know, that was one of the most important lessons that that we learned, is like, it's okay to evolve as an artist. It's okay to, you know, adapt your sound or you know, make it organic. You know, do what's who you really are. Don't fake who you are as an artist. Don't go one direction that you're not going to be happy with, because if you're not happy with that direction, you're going to burn out. You know, there's just, if you are making music that you truly in your soul are not happy with, you're going to burn out.
Let me then pose a question. How do you split the difference? How do you make sure that you are, as an artist or as a label, evolving but not pandering? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think the DJing has a lot to do with it. You know, when you are DJing these short 1.5 hour sets, it's more of a, you know, a dog and pony show where you're rolling out your biggest tracks and putting them together in a really, you know, interesting way, and you know, that's it. But the true art of DJing is when you're playing 5, 6, 7 hour sets. There is no way that you can do a 5, 6, 7 hour set playing music that you do not have passion for. I mean, there's just no way. So those are the sets where creatively I'm the most inspired, because you can really kind of spread your wings, take people on a journey, and play all kinds of different sounds. You know, you start off playing more progressive, you build it up, you have your peak hours, you have your peak of the set where you're banging it out, and then you've got, like, you know, your after hours part of the set where you're kind of getting twisted and running around the rabbit hole. So I think when you do those kind of sets, you really start to, you know, you remember who you are as an artist, you know, and through that, you're able to take that into the studio and make tracks that both represent you as an artist as well as, you know, work on the dance floor.
Landish, the new track from Marcus Schultz, available on his Los Angeles 12-inch, out now on Armada.
You seem to have a very novel concept of how the studio and the live setting commingle. I'm sure with a lot of artists, they sort of keep their studio lives and their live shows separate, both in their minds and in the way they produce. But let's talk about your new 12-inch Los Angeles. There seems to be this concept behind the album, so I think it'd be best for you to go ahead and explain it, because it seems like this is exactly what you're talking about. You know, taking the work you're doing in the studio, mixing tracks, and really catering it towards the live ethos.
Yeah, well, every year I do a city series compilation, and I dedicate it to a city that's inspired me during the year. And what it is, it's different than my artist albums. My artist albums is me in the studio collaborating with singers, writing the songs. It's 100% me. What I do on these compilations is it's a mix CD. It's a snapshot of my DJ set of the moment. But what I do different than any other compilation is I work hand in hand with each artist on that album, you know, directing them what I want the mood of this album to be, because it's representing the city. And this year, in 2012, the city is Los Angeles. So, you know, what I did is on each track, I've worked with the artist, you know, and we have crafted out the perfect journey that it is that I'm, that Los Angeles has inspired in me. And the nice thing about it is, when, like I said, when I work with each one of these artists and trying to direct them in how the track is supposed to evolve and how it's supposed to, what the vibe of the song is, now I have this whole library of music from this compilation that now I am able to play in my live sets, or this will make up a lot of my live sets for the next, you know, and through the summer till my artist album drops. And it also, you know, the other cool thing is it gives me the ammunition, the exclusive content and ammunition when I go and perform. I'm not, you know, reliant on playing other people's music that I didn't have a hand on. I mean, pretty much, I'd say maybe 90% of the music that I play, I've somehow had a hand on, whether it's A&Ring it, whether it's remixing it, producing it, you know, one way or the other, I've had a hand in the tracks. And I think that's what really makes my DJ sets and who I am as an artist different. And that's why I think when you go to hear me play, you know for sure, maybe I'll play a track that somebody else also plays, but you know that this track is coming from my camp, or it's something that I've had a hand on, like I said, whether it's A&Ring it, producing it, or remixing it, or even just, you know, reconstructing it, somehow I've had a hand in it.
How then did you express that LA vibe with your own track, Bolandish?
Well, Bolandish is something, you know, when I play in LA, I always play long sets at Avalon. And one of the things that I really enjoy in long sets is the after hours part. So Bolandish is definitely something that, you know, I put it at the end of the CD, because it's more of an after hours type of track. And, you know, that track, when I went in the studio, I that's what I wanted to make, is something that is played late night, like 4, 5, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, not in the peak hour, but a part of the night where it's just really, like, you know, people are just really twisted, and it's just a great vibe in the air. You know, people are used to my big arena style tracks, and that's cool. But on this compilation, because the after hours part of my sets are really, really important, I wanted to also kind of express that part of my DJ sets on this compilation.
Sure. Marcus Schultz, we got such a lesson today in the industry, and also it's just fascinating to hear someone who takes such care with their craft. Thanks so much for being on the UNS podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, and thank you guys for all your support.
That's going to do it for this week's program. Special thanks go to Tim Stark with Stark Profiles PR, Maria De Kunick, and of course, my guest, Marcus Schultz. His latest release, Los Angeles, is available now on Armada Music. He's hitting New York and Toronto on Friday and Saturday. Then he'll be at Armin van Buuren's Estate of Trance 550 at Den Bosch in the Netherlands at the end of March. At theUns.com/contest, we've got a Steve Aoki prize pack that includes his latest release, Wonderland. And if that's not incentive enough, we've got festival passes for Buku, Symbiosis, Wakarusa, and Aura Music and Arts Festival to give away. Please visit theUns.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review. Tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the Uns podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theuns.com. Join the conversation at the Uns podcast on Twitter. We'll catch you next week.